Support comes from the Missouri Forest Products Association, saluting Earth Day on April 22nd with an ongoing commitment to help offset carbon emissions with sustainable harvesting of Missouri forests. Details at choosewood.com.
From St. Louis Public Radio. This is St. Louis on the Air.
I feel it coming. This is a terrible idea. I'm very disappointed in my panel. And I hope you guys know I'm kind of joking. Maybe not. Anyway.
$1 billion here, $1 billion there. Pretty soon you're talking about real money.
Or you're out at a dinner party and you're telling somebody beside you what you told your lawyer in your divorce case. That could also be a waiver.
The St. Louis Police Department, quote, "where being cavalier about violence, particularly racial violence, was far too prevalent." I mean, we really got to take that to heart. That's the defense lawyer saying that.
To take their personal liberty, it's life-changing.
I'm Sarah Funsky. Today, we convene our legal roundtable, and the timing actually couldn't be better. So many matters in the news right now require the insight of expert attorneys. That includes a First Amendment claim by the Missouri Democratic Party and a ruling by the Missouri Supreme Court on a murder case that's gained national attention. It also includes the sentencing of Dustin Boone. He's the former St. Louis police officer found guilty of beating an undercover colleague. Yesterday, a federal judge handed down his sentence with a big deviation from federal guidelines. We'll discuss what happened there. But first, we need to discuss something happening right now, and that is the mediation underway today in the case of St. Louis governmental entities versus Stan Kroenke and the NFL. And joining us now to explain where we're at and where we could go next is a panel of top attorneys. That includes Bill Freivogel. He's a professor of journalism at Southern Illinois University Carbondale, as well as a lawyer. Bill, welcome.
Hi.
And we're also joined today by Eric Banks. He's a former city councilor and a former state prosecutor. He's now in private practice at Banks Law LLC. Eric, welcome.
Good afternoon. Thank you for having me back.
And last but not least, this month we're joined by Catherine Hanaway. She is a former speaker of the Missouri House, the former U.S. attorney for the Eastern District of Missouri, and currently the chair of the Hush Blackwell Law Firm. That's a national firm with more than 800 attorneys in 20 cities across the U.S. Catherine Hanaway, welcome.
Thank you, Sarah. It's great to be with Eric and Bill.
So let's get down to business here. The city, the county, and the sporting authority that maintains the dome sued Stan Kroenke and the NFL after the Rams abandoned the city for Los Angeles. And we've long discussed this matter as if it's the NFL and Stan Kroenke versus the St. Louis guys. In the past month, we learned that's not necessarily true. Bill, before we jump into the legal analysis here, give us the scoop. How are these previously aligned parties now potentially at odds?
Well, I think that happened when Kroenke said that he might, that his idea of what indemnifying the other owners as it related to court costs and other lawsuit costs was different than what the other owners had thought it was.
Because he'd offered to indemnify them.
He had offered to indemnify them. The other owners apparently have said in these closed meetings, according to the reports on them, that they never would have voted for the move had he not made that promise. But now, you know, he's saying that he was only referring to, let's see, legal fees and other litigation expenses, not settlements or judgments. Of course, the settlements and judgments could be the big amount. I mean, I think everybody thought when the Rams were leaving that there really was not likely to be a successful lawsuit to cause them problems. I mean, you probably asked us that on a legal roundtable, and we probably said, that never really amounts to much.
Yeah, but this is a long shot of a case.
Has amounted to a lot because, you know, as it turns out, there seems to be quite a bit of proof that that Kroenke and the league may have violated its own rules in going ahead with approving the move.
So and, we know that Kroenke said he would indemnify these people. The question comes down to what does that mean? Catherine, what would be the acceptable definition here? Is his interpretation correct? I only said I'd cover your lawyers. I didn't say I'd cover a judgment.
Well, I haven't seen the terms of the agreement, but, you know, I can't give you an opinion on whether he's right. What I can tell you is no one should be surprised that once again, Stan Kroenke hasn't lived up to his promises. Time and time again, this guy has showed hubris, a complete and utter lack of loyalty to any person or institution. I mean, all the way back to naming the arena at Mizzou the Page when she was having academic struggles elsewhere. And, you know, he could have left town. He could have left town with lots of hearts and flowers and what a great city we were. And I think it might have changed the tenor of this whole thing. But now, once again, he's showing disloyalty to another group. This time it happens to be the very powerful other owners of the NFL. And I would not be surprised if they do just as St. Louis has done and exercise every legal recourse they have to hold him to his promises.
Eric, this is all getting very interesting. I love that these two parties are potentially at each other's throats. And they're saying Stan Kroenke apparently sent this email to the NFL owners saying he thinks he can settle this case, but just for himself, for $500 million to $750 million. If he were to do that, could the city continue to go after the NFL for even more money?
Absolutely.
And should they?
Absolutely. Yes. And I feel like I am the voice in the wilderness here. And good thing that I'm not a decision maker, because I would have taken $100 million a few months ago. And the thought that I could have caused my client to have left $400, $500, $600 million on the table doesn't make me feel good at all. But yes, it is possible for, and let's just say the city, even though that's not the proper name, let's say the plaintiffs. It is possible for the plaintiffs to decide to settle with one party and leave the rest of the parties in play for the January 10th lawsuit. And my prediction is that that will either happen or everybody will settle on the eve of trial, being before January 10th, probably on the figurative courthouse steps.
So this could come down to the last minute here. Bill, I've seen some news coverage, people suggesting this mediation today could solve some things. No?
Well, I don't know about that. I mean, I think if I were the city in the position that it's now in, why settle with Kroenke for $500 million when you're looking at more than a billion, maybe several billion dollars down the road. I mean, I was reading an LA Times story today that went through the whole sad history, and you know they were saying how St. Louis asked for $550 million, and then they want part of they think they're entitled to part of the increase in the Rams' value since they left St. Louis, which is about $3 billion. And then there's tax revenue that St. Louis has lost. So the LA Times reporter was talking in terms of this could be a $4 billion case before it's done.
Catherine, I'm starting to see why Stan Kroenke wants to get out from under this thing.
Absolutely. And if I were the plaintiffs, I would not resolve it today with just Kroenke. Because thinking about this from sort of the perspective of trying it to a jury, he is the least sympathetic defendant. Mm-hmm. You want him in the room. You want mm-hmm. to be able to point to him. You want to be able to quote his words back about what a one-horse town St. Louis is. And the complexion of the case is entirely different if it's just against the NFL and these owners who haven't necessarily done anything directly to the detriment of St. Louis, and certainly didn't sort of take a dump on the welcome mat on their way out of town, you know. And so I'll be very surprised if there is a resolution with just Stan Kroenke today or even later. I think it'll be a global settlement with both, even if they negotiate with the plaintiffs separately.
Hmm. And so negotiating to say the NFL is going to end up cutting its own deal and have to be responsible for some of these costs, but later come after Kroenke for them?
No. I think they'll, you know, it'll be a global settlement, but Stan Kroenke and the NFL may not have resolved the dispute between them. Mm-hmm. So the plaintiffs will resolve with each of the parties, and then they can craft their own resolution between the two of them.
Boy, it seems like this is just going to be a field day for lawyers. I mean, y'all are just managing to, like, you know, make this very complicated in ways where I can just see those billable hours going up, up, up. Bill, well, I see you laughing.
Well, and I think some of the lawyers in this case have it on a contingent fee, so it could be quite a payday.
Yeah, I saw some references to some of the other owners' lawyers' fees already were in the five figures, so it's going up.
So no, I thought eight. I thought eight.
Oh, maybe
figures.
It was eight.
Yeah.
For
yeah,
the
yeah.
So one of the things I saw Stan Kroenke quoted as saying, or his sources close to him saying, he can't risk a trial without sharing the pain. But Catherine's analysis here that he is by far the biggest villain in this, shouldn't the NFL be the ones that goes and cuts the deal with St. Louis? And then he's, they could just say, hey, we'll just give you $100 million or something like that. And then he's stuck on his own, no?
No, I absolutely think that's right. If there's going to be one party that resolves with the plaintiffs and that the plaintiffs would be more likely to want to resolve with, it's the NFL. Mm-hmm. And they, may well start making overtures separately from Kroenke.
So, Catherine and Eric, maybe you can tell me, but why should the city of St. Louis want to settle instead of going to trial and just dragging out all of these horrible emails, the AMF, adios, MFers, document. I mean, before a St. Louis jury, what is the reason for not starting the trial at least?
Well, as far as I'm concerned, the reason is that a fast nickel beats a slow dime. And just like anything can happen with a jury trial, anything can happen with the Court of Appeals. And I was sitting next to an attorney last Thursday at an awards banquet, and he told me about a case that he had where the decision was rendered by the Supreme Court 2.5 years after the argument. So if your average appeal lasts 18 months to 2 years, something this important, one of the biggest legal cases I've ever read about in my lifetime, I could see the appeals going up 3 or 4 years. What happens if the Court of Appeals doesn't overrule it but just sends it back? And we have to start all of this all over again. So my attitude is take the money, be adverse to risk. If you can get $750 million from Kroenke and $250 million from the NFL, that's $1 billion. And who knows, in my opinion, $1 billion here, $1 billion there. Pretty soon you're talking about real money.
We do need to take a quick break, but we'll be back shortly. When we come back, we'll talk about that sentence handed down in federal court yesterday for former St. Louis police officer Dustin Boone. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio.
Support comes from the Missouri Forest Products Association, saluting Earth Day on April 22nd with an ongoing commitment to help offset carbon emissions with sustainable harvesting of Missouri forests. Details at choosewood.com.
Welcome back. Today, our legal roundtable is in session, and that includes three knowledgeable attorneys. Eric Banks is a former city councilor and a former state prosecutor. He's now in private practice at Banks Law, LLC. Catherine Hanaway is a former speaker of the Missouri House. She's the former U.S. attorney for the Eastern District of Missouri, and she's also currently chair of the Hush Blackwell Law Firm. And Bill Freivogel is a professor of journalism at Southern Illinois University Carbondale. He is also an attorney. Now, we've been talking about the Rams, and that is not the only high-profile case with attorneys racking up billable hours this week. Yesterday, Dustin Boone was sentenced in federal court, and Boone is the former St. Louis police officer found guilty of beating an undercover colleague, Luther Hall. Prosecutors had sought 10 years. Defense attorneys asked for just over 2 years. Well, U.S. District Judge Richard Weber gave Boone a sentence of just 1 year and 1 day. That's below federal guidelines. Federal guidelines actually suggest the prosecutors were right in line. That suggests 10 years is appropriate. So this is, it's fair to say, a surprisingly short sentence. Catherine Hanaway, you were the U.S. attorney. What do you think is going on here?
Well, I think that's a super tough question. I want to say a few things about this case. First of all, it was a great sign of courage that the U.S. attorney and the assistant U.S. attorneys charged this case and have pursued it relentlessly.
They could have given up after the mistrial.
They could have not charged this case. And the essential facts are that Detective Hall was undercover in the post-Shockley demonstrations downtown and was beaten by several city police officers. And interestingly, in this case, Dustin Boone's defense team, when arguing for a lighter sentence, argued that there was a culture of going after demonstrators and of racism in the city police department. All of this is heartbreaking. I want to, again, start with the courage shown by the U.S. Attorney's Office in bringing the charges and continuing to relentlessly pursue them. Carrie Costanton, who's the first assistant U.S. attorney, has been in that office for decades. She is an extraordinarily talented lawyer. After the mistrial, she went right back and got a conviction and asked for a sentence consistent with the guidelines. Mm-hmm. I was shocked by the sentence yesterday, and I was mostly shocked because Judge Weber is one of the best judges in the Eastern District of Missouri, has a long, abiding, vigorous commitment to ending racism in our community, has spoken out on it repeatedly. Now, I will say that when I was U.S. attorney, he also did have a reputation for being the judge most likely to be merciful towards a defendant. Hmm. And I think that in all likelihood, that is what happened here. Mr. Boone did not actually kick, punch Detective Hall. He did hold him down. He had communications suggesting very clearly that he relished the opportunity to go after demonstrators. But there were two other police officers who were kicking and punching Detective Hall, who got about 4 years. Mm-hmm. And then there were a couple of others who were completely acquitted. And so I think Judge Weber was probably trying to proportionally sentence Mr. Boone where at the level he believed his responsibility was.
Mm-hmm. Bill, what do you make of this?
Well, I agree with Catherine about the applauding the U.S. attorney continuing to pursue this case. I mean, this was a very strong case. I mean, the victim here is a officer of the law,
yeah,
doing his duty, and there was a number of officers ended up turning state's evidence. There were all of these horrible messages that Boone and others were sending around about how much they relished what they were doing.
And also very racist.
Very
text
racist.
Messages.
Racist.
Even beyond wanting to beat protesters, this was a clear animosity towards everyone who has that skin color different than them.
Yeah, very strong racial animus. Against the St. Louis Circuit Attorneys and the Circuit Attorney's Office against black people in general. So the evidence was very strong. But as Catherine knows from having been U.S. attorney, convicting a police officer is very difficult, and you have a high burden of proof in doing that. But for him to, for Boone to end up with just 1 year when the person who turned state's evidence gets 4 years, although, concededly started the beating, it doesn't encourage anybody to tell the truth about what happened in a situation like this. I mean, I like Judge Weber. I actually wrote an endorsement editorial on his behalf once as an editorial writer on the Post Dispatch, and he walked down 12th Street to thank me for it. Sit down and thank me for it. I like him a lot, but I really think he got this one wrong.
So, Eric, one of the things that made my jaw drop is that the Post-Dispatch reports that the fact that he gave him a year and a day instead of just giving him a year means that he can earn good time credit. And so that sentence makes it less than a year because he tacked on that extra day. He qualifies for something that would allow him to get an even earlier release. What do you make of all this?
Well, I have lost cases in front of Judge Weber. But in spite of that, I'm still not objective when it comes to this issue because of the high respect that I have of Judge Weber. We have disagreed on things in the past, but as far as I'm concerned, he's one of the finest human beings that's ever walked the face of the earth. And for that reason, I'm going to err on the side of believing that because of information that he was privy to, such as a pre-sentence investigator report, that he has the superior knowledge. And while on the surface I may disagree with his decision, I'm going to give him the benefit of the doubt and think that he did the right thing.
So something that I always come into these kind of decisions with is, man, judges have so much discretion on what they can do. And I start to get really wound up about it. And then I think about all these cases where judges' hands are tied and that I can get really wound up about this. Catherine, overall, do you think it's a good thing that judges have the discretion that you know, we have a guideline that says 10 years, that a judge can pull it down so it's lower than a year, and that's perfectly acceptable?
I do. To Eric's point, we may not have all of the information here, and more than once, people have asked me to take an appointment to become a judge, and consistently, I've turned it down for all kinds of reasons, but one of the important ones is how difficult sentencing is. That decision to sentence someone to take their personal liberty, it's life-changing, it's life-altering, and they have to do it every day. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's really tough. And I certainly also will give Judge Weber the benefit of the doubt on this one, that he had some very solid reason from departing below the guidelines. But there are times we want the judges to depart above the guidelines. I remember, and I don't recall his name, Mike Devlin, when he kidnapped those two boys in Kirkwood. Judge Hamilton, went triple the guidelines. And thank goodness she had that discretion mm-hmm. to do that. He was a horrific criminal. And so judges need discretion. There are family circumstances. There are economic circumstances, mental health and well-being circumstances that sometimes mandate argue for a sentence below the guidelines. Other times, the nature of the crime should be above the guidelines, and we want judges to be able to be right there, up close, have all the facts, and make those evaluations.
You know, the defense lawyers, amongst the things they said, was what a great dad and family man he is, and maybe that, you know, maybe that affected Judge Weber. But boy, you read some of the families' social media messages about monkeys in the zoo and bananas and et cetera, et cetera. The stepdad, the mother, the sister, was just shocking. Yeah. But I guess it's not too surprising that he came out of that family life with the views that he has. I mean, I think the final admission by the Boone lawyers, you know, that line where the St. Louis Police Department, quote, where being cavalier about violence, particularly racial violence, was far too prevalent. I mean, we really got to take that to heart. That's the defense lawyer saying that.
So it sounds like for the three of you, and I hear so much respect for Judge Weber in this room, it almost takes me aback to hear such fulsome praise from three panelists with very different life perspectives, that maybe the wake-up call here is not this sentence, but the bigger picture of what's going on with the St. Louis Police Department.
That's what I would say.
So we have a lot of other matters to discuss, but we do have a caller who has a good question that relates to our previous discussion about Stan Kroenke and the NFL. I'm going to go back to this for just a moment here. Patrick is calling from Rock Hill. Patrick, hi. You're on St. Louis on the Air.
Hey, sir. Thanks for taking my call. Just wanted to ask you guys, you talked about potential cash settlements as an option for the city, but there's been talk of maybe an expansion team or a stadium as part of a settlement. Kind of a two-part question. Why would the city want to do that with the NFL as part of a settlement after the NFL's been here and left twice? And on the other side, why wouldn't the NFL want to do that and just get the money right back in their pockets from fans and everything else being in the media market?
Patrick, I think that's a great question. I'm not a football fan. I'm like, why would St. Louis want another football team? But I keep hearing this every time we talk about this, people saying, can we get a team out of this? Catherine, could you see that being part of a settlement here?
I don't think it is likely to be part of a settlement because the economics of it are so unknown, both to the league and to the city. Like, but I think both parties would be a little hesitant at this point. I am a huge NFL fan, like ridiculously obsessed. It's terrible. I try not to say that too much in St. Louis because everyone else hates the NFL. But it is a fantastic sport. And I will tell you the thing, the reason I wish we'd get an NFL team back here more than being a fan is I travel the country. We now are in 25 cities ranging from Oakland to Boston. And other executives, other civic leaders, people who might do business in certain places refer to the NFL cities. And it's a certain tier below which in some ways we have dropped by not having a team. Now, I'm optimistic that soccer is the future of professional sports and that the soccer team is going to improve our stature. But I think it's unlikely we'll get a team. I think it's much more likely we're going to get a big cash settlement. But in some ways, I think it's unfortunate.
In terms of getting a team, I mean, what would this even look like? Let's say the NFL is like, yep, as part of the settlement, we're going to give you a team. Who would even get that team? Does anyone have a sense of how that would work? They just auction off a team and line their own pockets again?
Some billionaire would get it.
Yeah. You can stipulate to that.
That is the ultimate exclusive club, being an NFL owner. Once you've owned everything else, you can do that. To deal with the caller's very, very good first point, why would St. Louis want to do it? The answer is because St. Louis is a world-class sports town. No matter what else you may say about us, we just love our sports, and that's all of the sports. And for that New York minute before the new league shut down, there were a lot of us attending the games at the Edward Jones Dome and having a very good time and looking for more. And it was quite unfortunate that they shut the league down.
This is the Battle Hawks?
Yes.
You're a Battle Hawks fan, Eric?
I was when they were here, yes.
Wow, I'm surrounded by football fans. Bill, take my side in this. We don't want an NFL team, please.
I actually would like to have an NFL team. But I can. I know, but my wife, if she's listening, would just be covering her face. But yeah, pro sports. We are a great sports town. But I do have, you know, like in the back of my mind, I'm thinking about Bill McCollum's column on Sunday where he said, you know, some way or another, St. Louis is going to just mess this up and it's and end up on the short end of the stick.
Yeah, and my theory on how we're going to mess this up, I'm with Patrick, our caller. You know, why would we take this team? They'll probably give us a team and they'll put all these different clauses in here where we will absolutely get screwed again and have to buy a whole new stadium again. I feel it coming. This is a terrible idea. I'm very disappointed in my panel. And I hope you guys know I'm kind of joking. Maybe not. Anyway, we're talking today to our football-loving legal roundtable. That is Bill Freivogel, Eric Banks, and Catherine Hanaway. We do need to take a quick break, if only so I can clear my disgust, and we will be back to talk about the Missouri Democratic Party and their fight with the National Labor Relations Board. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio.
Support comes from the Missouri Forest Products Association, saluting Earth Day on April 22nd with an ongoing commitment to help offset carbon emissions with sustainable harvesting of Missouri forests. Details at choosewood.com.
Welcome back. Today we're talking to our legal roundtable. Now we need to talk about the Missouri Democratic Party. In addition to losing a whole lot of clout in the state of Missouri, Democrats have drawn the attention of the National Labor Relations Board. A former data specialist working for the party filed a charge with the board. He said he'd been fired from his position with the party to discourage efforts to unionize that party. And so the party's fighting back. They say the National Labor Relations Board is in unprecedented
unprecedented territory here, that it's never sat in judgment over a political party like this. And they say this amounts to government interference in political speech, and that violates the First Amendment. Eric Banks, is the party on solid legal ground with that defense?
Not in my opinion, and running the risk of having my Democratic card yanked by saying this, to claim that they are the victim because they tried to assert First Amendment arguments is a, and they're exercising the rights under the First Amendment. That's a stretch in my opinion. So I'm with the union on this one.
So they say they're not engaged in commerce in sort of the classic definition of the Labor Relations Act. Do you think the Missouri Democratic Party engages in commerce? They're not winning many elections.
I cannot think of too many folks who exist without engaging in commerce. Mm-hmm. I think that when I buy a stamp and put it on an envelope and mail it to somebody to advocate for a position one way or the other, that's engaged in commerce. So I am not buying the argument that they're not engaged in commerce. There are certain statutes that define what engaging in commerce means. Some say, well, if you have revenues of $250,000, if you have revenues of $500,000, there are ways to limit the definition for engaging in commerce, but I don't see any of those being imposed here.
So, Catherine, National Labor Relations Board having power over a political party, what could go wrong?
Oh, all kinds of things could go wrong. And look here, this is critically important to understand in this definition of commerce and whether or not the Democratic Party should be protected by the First Amendment. There are a whole line of cases that say political contributions are speech, right? That's a form of speech. So when the Democratic Party spends its money, that shouldn't transform that speech into commerce. And as much as I might disagree with just about everything they have to say, I think they should be able to speak and not be governed by the National Labor Relations Board and its employees allowed to unionize. Everything about political campaigns can be corrupted by that decision, quite honestly. When you start putting a certain set of rules around who can work for and how many hours they can work for and how much money has to be spent on people who are trying to speak. And quite honestly, and you know, maybe I'm way overstepping my grounds here, but most of what you do, and I've been one of those grunts in a political party, most of the work you do is way beyond the hours allowed for anyone to work at much lower pay. But you do it because you are passionate about a point of view, and you're doing it to speak out. Mm-hmm. And so I do think it's protected by the First Amendment and should continue to be, and the National Labor Relations Board should not seek to impose its rules upon the Democratic Party.
So, Bill, that's quite a defense of a Republican for the Missouri Democratic Party here. Do you share her concerns about, you know, if they are allowed to have jurisdiction here, what this could mean for political parties?
And the First Amendment defense, too. So that was great. And you know, I defer to Catherine about knowing how would this practically affect a political party. I mean, she knows and I have no clue. But I mean, you do have to look at the statute that defines employer. And it has exclusions for the United States, Federal Reserve Banks, state government, labor unions themselves, but it doesn't have any exemption for political parties. And, you know, and let's keep, you know, the First Amendment argument's a good one, but
it doesn't right now, Bill. I assure you, if this case goes the wrong way, Congress will ask.
Okay, well, you know, so much the better to have. Yeah. But, I mean, you know, you do have to look at the statute, and there is a Supreme Court decision that says NLRB has jurisdiction over media. I mean, certainly the media, the press, is in the First Amendment. So I don't think that necessarily the First Amendment would trump what the statute seems to say.
So I get why.
I actually think Bill may be right on the immediate outcome, but I think from a practical perspective, Congress will come back and fix this. Yeah. Yeah.
This is eventually something that would have to go to the Supreme Court if this stands.
Supreme Court, or it could be a legislative change before it even gets to the court, and I would not be shocked at all to see that.
So I have to say, I mean, I get that workers, a broad swath of workers should be entitled to union protections. I'm sympathetic to that argument, but I think about what if Donald Trump was president and this was a Republican administration coming down on a state Democratic Party. That makes me kind of nervous. We want an opposition that doesn't have to fear the federal government. Eric, do you see any, am I in the wrong boat to be making that kind of claim here?
No, I certainly see your position, but I think that this is an issue that's not affected by who the president is. If for no other reason, so many decisions that administrative bodies make or don't rise to the level of the political appointees who serve on the board that governs the entity, in this case, of course, the National Labor Relations Board. The real heavy lifting, in my opinion, is done by the lifelong career people. And I don't think that this would be affected by who the President of the United States was.
Hmm. It does seem like this is this growing trend where liberal left-leaning organizations are looking to unionize their own staff. And we see this now at places like the ACLU, and we're seeing this for the Missouri Democratic Party. And yet it's weird with political parties because so many of these workers, they're hired on just for the election cycle. And the understanding is always you get fired when this election is over. It does seem like if we have a bunch of unionized workers running around, it really changes the game that you referred to there.
Oh, it was definitely change the complexion, and particularly if they had, rights to not be terminated, it could completely change the level of energy behind campaigns. And that's what I'm concerned about. Like, campaigns do take just an enormous amount of energy and vitality and passion, and to all do it for, less than a living wage and hours that nobody would want to work. And that's not to say that the NLRB should not exercise its authority for some of these other organizations to be organized under union rules. But when it so directly impacts the ability to state a message and impact the outcome of elections, I think it's protected by the First Amendment. And whether it's the U.S. Supreme Court or the Congress who fixes the statute, I think one way or the other, the Democratic Party will not be forced to organize, which, by the way, I think its opposition is very ironic. We should not let that go by.
I mean, fair point right there. I got to break in here with some breaking news here. A judge has set aside the conviction of Kevin Strickland. This is some news coming out of Kansas City, a very prominent wrongful conviction case there. They've ordered him immediately released from custody. Strickland spent more than 40 years behind bars. The judge concluded that prosecutors provided convincing evidence that undermined Strickland's conviction in the 1978 murder of three people. And this is coming from Judge James Welsh. He's a retired appeals court judge. He granted the motion filed by prosecutor Gene Peters Baker. This is the first of its kind under a new Missouri law that could be used in these kind of exonerations. Bill, we have talked about this new law on this show. There's hopes it could be applied here in St. Louis.
Right. Lamar Johnson, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So big news in KC. They have now successfully applied this.
Well, I think that's great. I mean, I do think that a prosecutor, a prosecutor's ultimate goal is justice, and if the facts have changed as they had in that case, and it seems like in the Johnson case, and there's no longer enough evidence for conviction, I think it's perfectly appropriate for a prosecutor to go, and not just appropriate, it's the ethical thing to do for a prosecutor to say, hey, there's new evidence, we don't have a conviction anymore.
So moving from breaking news, I want to get to another case involving prosecutors. This past month, the Missouri Supreme Court weighed in on a high-profile Ozark County murder. This is some grisly stuff here. A woman named Rebecca Rudd has been charged in the death of her 16-year-old daughter, Savannah Leckie. She gave Savannah up for adoption as a baby, and they later reunited with tragic results. Prosecutors say Rebecca Rudd and her now husband killed the teen and dismembered her and burned her body to cover up that crime. Well, that prosecution has
dragged on for 5 years now, and one reason is a big legal battle that was finally decided this past month. It involves a recording of a conversation between Rudd and a staff member at the public defender's office. And in it, this alleged murderess apparently confessed to some of these charges. Now, the mother, again, this defendant here, she herself made the recording, and then she put it in a box she gave to her husband, who's also charged with murder in this case. Robert Peet Jr. did not look in the box for over a year, but after he did and found the recording, he listened to it and turned it over to the Ozark County Sheriff. Now, if the recording is covered by attorney-client privilege, it cannot be used in court, and the circuit court had previously said that. This past month, the Missouri Supreme Court overruled the lower court, and they ruled that attorney-client privilege does not apply. So in this case, you know, this woman was talking to her lawyer one-on-one. As a layman, not a lawyer, this seems to me like, hey, this is attorney-client privilege. Bill, what factor would be at play here that would say, okay, you know, her co-defendant can just turn this over?
Well, I think what the Missouri Supreme Court decided, and it makes sense to me. I'm no expert on attorney-client privilege, but it makes sense to me that she waived the privilege because she turned it over and without saying, hey, don't hand this over to anybody without any kind of strings attached.
But she didn't give it to him going, hey, here's a recording of me talking to my lawyer. She said, here's some of my stuff. Hold this for me.
Yeah, right.
That's enough to waive attorney-client privilege?
Well, I think it is, yeah.
Yeah, and importantly, the court did find, as Bill said, that the communication, what she said to, even though it wasn't a lawyer for the public defender, it was another kind of employee, but they were acting on behalf of the public defender. That communication was privileged, but the important lesson for, and it doesn't just come up in these gruesome cases. I deal with privilege pretty regularly in my practice, and you got to jealously guard it. Mm-hmm. It belongs to you, the client, in whatever context, but if you reveal the contents of the communication to your lawyer to some third party, whether it's putting it in a box and inadvertently giving it to your spouse or ex-spouse and not asking them to keep it confidential and keep their paws off and not listen to it. She did nothing to sort of protect that tape. It acted as a waiver. Whether it's that or you're out at a dinner party and you're telling somebody besides you what you told your lawyer in your divorce case, that could also be a waiver. Hmm. So as the client, you need to jealously guard the confidentiality of those communications with your lawyer in order to preserve the privilege.
Catherine, do you think if she had turned this box over to her husband and said, whatever you do, don't touch this recording, don't listen to it, this needs to be kept confidential, even though if I'm the husband, I'd then go, I got to listen to this right away, that would have actually maybe maintained the privilege.
I think it would get closer, and certainly if she had put some kind of a lock and key on the box, I think then the court would say, oh yes, she was trying to protect her privilege, and it was a privileged communication, and there is no waiver.
Hmm. So, Eric, I frequently turn to you in matters of common sense, and I have to wonder here, what was this woman doing recording this conversation in the first place?
Well, I could say a lot of self-deprecating remarks about that, but I will say that perhaps an error of judgment. I agree with the other two panelists, and I'll draw a couple of analogies. One is the idea of trade secrets. And if you have if you're a company and you don't jealously protect your proprietary interests in the form of a trade secret, then it can be waived. In addition to that, the other analogy that I'll raise is expectation of privacy. If I have some compromising photographs of myself and throw them in the trash bin and somebody else picks them up and publishes them, then I don't have a cause for relief against that person because I had no reasonable expectation of privacy because I threw the photographs away. Mm-hmm. So I think the same types of analogies would be determinative here. Whatever claim to attorney-client privilege that she might have had was waived when she gave that tape away. Even though it was to her husband, mm-hmm. I don't think a spousal immunity applies to anything here. And even though he was a co-defendant.
Hmm. So it sounds like the Missouri Supreme Court got this one right.
I believe they did.
Yeah, I think so.
Well, that's a huge relief because honestly, it sounds like this woman needs to go to prison.
Yeah. We should be rooting for this outcome here, right? One of the most fascinating little parts of this is the prosecutors have averred that no one in their office has even listened to this tape, that once the sheriff's office said it had what it had, that, you know, this became this whole legal battle. They've been waiting for years now to listen to this recording. Can you imagine what must have happened when this came down on November 9th? This must have been like just the most jaw-dropping listen.
Immediately.
So something else that has some national attention on it. Courts are now grappling with Texas's new law that empowers private citizens to sue over abortions that happen in that state. And a pair of local luminaries wrote an essay in the Post-Dispatch saying that there's a precedent right here in St. Louis that this shouldn't be as complicated as all the national pundits are saying that it is. This is former Clayton Mayor Ben Uchitel. He's an adjunct professor at UMSL who teaches the Constitution. And Stephen Skranka, he's the former general counsel of the ACLU of St. Louis. So they say this matter isn't that complicated, and they point to Shelley versus Kramer. This is a landmark 1948 case out of St. Louis that found racial covenants are unconstitutional and unenforceable. Bill, what does this have to do with abortion?
Well, yeah, that was this was a big case out of St. Louis. What the Supreme Court found in Shelley versus Kramer was that not that the covenant itself was unconstitutional, but that for the state to enforce it was unconstitutional. So you got to have state action in a case like this. Shelley was a guy who came to St. Louis, worked in the small arms factory on Goodfellow right before World War II. He said he came here and he couldn't go to places like the Fox. He couldn't go to Sportsman's Park, where the Cardinals played. He wanted to buy a house because his wife and six children joined him from Mississippi. And that's where he ran into this restrictive covenant that covered an entire part of St. Louis. Mm-hmm. Said that the house couldn't be sold to them. So it went all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court. It was a very tough case because you had to find state action. And the restrictive covenant was an entirely private agreement. And the Supreme Court said in that case, that state court to enforce a restrictive covenant would be state action, and so therefore, since enforcing a restrictive covenant would violate equal protection of the law under the 14th Amendment, that enforcement would be unconstitutional. So how does this affect Texas? So Texas abortion law is totally written in a way in which it's enforceable by private parties suing and not enforced by the state, by state officials themselves. So is there any state action? And so far the Supreme Court, but the courts have been having trouble finding state action. And so the argument would be, and I agree with Uchitel and Skranka, that the argument is that for the state courts to award one of these private citizens for having turned in a person complicit in helping a person get an abortion, for the state courts to enforce the payment of that award to the private citizen would be just like would be state action, just like enforcement of the restrictive covenant would be. Now, I don't know whether that's how the U.S. Supreme Court will end up deciding things. Actually, the Rehnquist Supreme Court narrowed what kinds of actions could be considered to be state action. I'm not sure Shelley versus Kramer would come out the same way today as it did then. State action is not as broadly interpreted now by the Supreme Court as it was then. So we'll see how this all turns out.
Catherine, do you see applicability here?
I think it's a little bit of a stretch, and I think the court has a ways to go yet. I think there are real issues of whether the cases that are currently making their way up to the Supreme Court their ripeness issues, their standing issues. So I don't think we're going to know the outcome for quite some time. But I greatly admire Ben and his colleague for bringing this case back to the forefront. It's an important part of jurisprudence that has its roots here in St. Louis and frankly, a case that we ought to keep talking about because, thank goodness, racial covenants are gone, but some of the informal legacy of it that keeps this community divided or still sort of omnipresent?
I'm glad you brought that up. Actually, St. Louis Public Radio has had a series of stories about that just this week, talking about how these covenants are still kind of lurking there in people's property records, and how if you examine where they are today, that you can see, you know, the historic discrimination has led to some of the current problems we have in our city. So if people want to read that story, you can go to stlpr.org. There's actually a whole series of stories. I feel like I've never talked so much about a case from 1948 as I have in the last week. Now this coming up on Legal Roundtable, and this being a topic that we've talked about having the reporters on in this case, it just goes to show, you know, the past is not dead, right? I mean, we're still kind of stuck with it and its tentacles. Anyone want to argue with me on that? There has to be a good legal argument on that. Well, I want to thank our Legal Roundtable for joining us today. Certainly, we had a lot of interesting discussions on a whole lot of levels, even if it turns out they are all fans of the NFL. Catherine Hanaway, I want to thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Sarah.
Do you now root for the Chiefs? Is that where you've gone?
I do root for the Chiefs, okay, vigorously. And I must admit, I root for the Cowboys because Ezekiel Elliott's a St. Louis guy. So
okay. There's something I can't even begin to argue with because I have no idea who she's talking about. Catherine, thanks again for joining us. Catherine is the chair of the Hush Blackwell Law Firm. Bill Freivogel, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
What do you do with your NFL energy?
I don't root for anybody right now.
And Bill is a professor of journalism at Southern Illinois University, Carbondale. Eric Banks of Banks Law LLC, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. And I only have two concluding comments. Go Chiefs and M-I-Z.
Oh, Z-O-U.
Yeah, okay.
This episode was produced by Sarah Fenske, with audio engineering by Aaron Dorr and production assistance from Jane Mather Glass. This podcast was mixed and edited by Aaron. Our executive producer is Alex Hoyer.
St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio. Understanding starts here. If you learned something new from today's episode, consider leaving us a review and rating on Apple Podcasts on the App Store. It's the easiest way to help people discover our show. We appreciate it. Thank you. St. Louis Public Radio is a member-supported service of the University of Missouri, St. Louis.
Support comes from the Missouri Forest Products Association, saluting Earth Day on April 22nd with an ongoing commitment to help offset carbon emissions with sustainable harvesting of Missouri forests. Details at choosewood.com.